Well, welcome to the abbreviated After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, but I am thrilled to have in studio because we've been talking, we spent the last 10 minutes talking about Mike Rico's famous Rib Fest, and if Stephen Evans Jordan decides to write a second novel, I think it should be about the Rib Fest. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's flattered. My pleasure. It's my pleasure. We have a lot of mutual friends.
Yeah, we do.
We should name the two Irish mafiosi.
Pat Hickey and Mike Houlihan.
Mike Houlihan.
And a cast of other people I haven't met yet. But.
Well, watch yourself.
Oh, I know.
That's all I can say. Stephen, your first novel, Tatiana and the Russian Wolves, is, to my mind, I read it last week, remarkably ambitious, but also incredibly successful. What is your background as a writer? You have a lengthy background as a financier.
Banker, yeah. And you spend a lot of time writing as a banker, and primarily credit reports, loan proposals.
Yeah.
And I found the best way to do those is get to the point as quickly as you possibly can and say, look, here's the deal. Boom, ba-boom. You know, here's the money's going to be used for this. Here's how we're going to get repaid. Now we can start doing the background. It's been around since 1863 and that. The other stuff was I read a lot, and years ago, when I was in high school, I started noticing the various styles and how quickly can you get through a book.
Who are some of your favorite early writers?
Evelyn Waugh, I loved him. His early stuff was black humor and quite funny. And then the other one was Elmore Leonard, who, God, they're funny.
Boy, that is so, I have rarely heard those two fellows
in the same
sentence as influences. Evelyn Waugh and Elmore Leonard. You have great taste, let me tell you that.
Well, my first draft was...
What compelled you to even do a first draft?
I was in Tanzania working with a central bank on some debt issues they had. And free time in the third world hangs heavy. I mean, it was sort
sure.
of... The movies were in Swahili. The TVs, if they had them, they had corn reading contests. You know, this and that, or going to the English club and seeing how much warm beer you could drink in a night.
Yeah, right.
And that gets tedious.
Sure.
And I had an idea for this, not this book that you're holding, but, I mean, an idea about Russia. I've been fascinated with Russia since I was a boy.
Why?
I saw a movie in 1953, I think it was called Tatiana, and it was with Ingrid Bergman as Tatiana, as Anastasia. And Yul Brynner as sort of this Cossack thing. And it was an amazing movie, and I was watching this, and I started reading an awful lot about it, and her in particular. And I was a history major in college, and I took a lot of Russian history and then took this depressing, called The Russian Novel. And I remember I was not, it was sort of off my food.
Well, Russian history, being half Russian, I can say this knowing a little bit, Russian history itself can be pretty depressing.
It is, but I was reading Dostoevsky about one a week.
Oh,
and, and it was winter quarter.
Uh-huh.
And winter quarter, in Palo Alto, California isn't all that bad, it's just a little dark. And I kept reading these things, and I finally went over to see the student health center, and they put me...
said, help me!
Yeah, I said, I'm just, anything wrong? And I was talking to a psychologist, and I said, no, deaths, no, breakup girlfriends, nope. And he said, what are you taking? And so I told him the courses. I said, there's one called The Russian Novel. He said...
Don't do that.
I told them...
Don't reschedule
that for this summer or maybe the spring, something else like that. Because inevitably, for the 5 years I've been here, somebody like you comes over about once every year and goes, why am I so depressed? And it's because of the stuff you're reading.
So that came back. I mean, so you're in Tanzania thinking to yourself, wait a minute, I'm going to use my knowledge of Russia to craft... a novel, that's a tough thing. Writing a novel is a tough thing.
Hmm.
It is a very difficult thing. Did it go smoothly from the outset? I can't imagine.
It didn't. Going back to Elmore Leonard and Evelyn Waugh, the first draft was sort of like a head-on collision between Brideshead Revisited and Get Shorty. It was just...
I would have liked to have read that.
Too. I should have kept it. I tossed it, but, I sent it to Monty Python or something, but it was just, Steve, this is ridiculous. I mean, we've got it, And it took about 20 years to do that. I spent a lot of time in drawers, and then coming back and doing a critical read on it, getting rid of the banking minutiae, Understanding the Russians, and then also what happened to there are two very good books. One is called The Other Russias, Other Russians. It was by emigres who had left after the revolution, and another one was called the Russian Fascists, which were primarily emigres who really hated communism.
But so you tossed that stuff in a drawer, but it stayed with you for a number of years. Would you get it out and revise? I mean, it obviously was not on your mind 24 hours a day. You had a job.
But no, it was just, you know, bus rides, airplane trips, stuff like that. Just started thinking about it and going, no. And what I started to do consciously was make it into a relatively small world that was spinning fairly quickly with a limited number of characters, unlike Russian novels. That, and make it as tight as you possibly could, as I possibly could. And then, you know, what is the primary motivation for the people, the major characters in the book?
You're right. There are not a lot of major characters, and you can really keep focused in this. But in many ways, this is a book about a mother and a son.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm going to read, if you don't mind. The last graph of your prologue really grabbed me. Had it not, I never would have gone on to all these preceding chapters. But you write, this again is from Stephen Evans Jordan's new novel. His first novel, Tatiana and the Russian Wolves. Russian Wolves meaning?
Meaning people that are depressed or deal with depression often name it. Winston Churchill called his the black dog that would show up, and she called them the Russian Wolves.
Yeah, it's a fascinating term. You write, memories of my mother often take me back to the garden behind our home in Berkeley, where we took afternoon tea and considered my Americanization. Her advice was simple. Do what you have to do. She was preoccupied. My adjustments impeded our wanderings. We were travelers. Art books and museums were departure gates. Her incredible imagination allowed her to walk into paintings, explore the settings, and talk to the subjects. When I was a boy, I followed her. But after she died, I put away such make-believe. That's a very, very polished paragraph.
Thank you.
You know that.
I spent a lot of time on it.
Yeah. But he doesn't, the protagonist of the book, doesn't stop communing with his mom, does he?
No, he doesn't. And he sees her, he dreams of her an awful lot, which more or less cracks open the code later on. And he's terrified of the insanity that took her. She committed suicide. If that was stalking him as well.
Yeah.
And so he went out and said, oh, let's see, an artist or a banker? Well, a banker will get rid of all those influences, and it did there for a while.
Well, his life is broken apart early on in the book by what?
He was in Russia at the behest of the Soviet government on a pipeline that now exists between Russia and Western Europe. They wanted hard currency financing for it. And he runs into a retired Russian secret police general who tells him, he knew this, but that he tries to blackmail him, that his father, his paternal grandfather and his maternal uncle returned with the Nazis and worked for them.
Yeah.
And then also that his mother worked for Tatiana herself, spent her time in World War II alone in Paris, and she had worked at first with one of the big Paris galleries. And those things became just pirates in terms of the art collections that were coming at them, and so that they, primarily Jewish in many cases, so that they could have the cash or they could somehow negotiate their way out. And so that's where he starts deciding, or has decided, to start, let's untangle my mother's background, because I think some people know about it, and they do, and I want to get that in the bottom. But then when he's doing that, his life starts unraveling.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, fascinating story. It is in some part mystery, in some part thriller, I believe. And in some part, in the grand tradition of great Russian family sagas, a family saga. We got to take a short little break, and I'll continue on with Stephen Evans Jordan, who this week, we will tell you precisely when, will be at the lovely Oak Park Library, a visit arranged by Debbie Prizer, who gets huge, wonderful crowds out to hear authors. You going to read from the book out there?
I was going to read the first and second paragraphs.
Why don't you just take this show and you can
just record it.
Just take my recording of it. I'll tell you, before we take a break, Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best, stupidest commercial ever, Sundays at 10. You can't be doing that because you're listening to this. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I have not enough time, never enough time. I've got 8 more minutes with Stephen Evans Jordan, the author of a wonderful novel, Tatiana and the Russian Wolves. It is about Tatiana has been gone for 20 years, roughly, when the story begins, and her son goes about unraveling her life, in essence, right?
Yeah.
People love this book, in addition to me, Jim Lehrer, who I know and greatly admire. He was the former news anchor of the PBS NewsHour. He had to say about this book, "There is for me a first test of any novel. Do I want to turn the next page and keep reading it? After reading the first 83 pages of Tatiana and the Russian Wolves, I can say Stephen Evans Jordan knows how to write and how to tell a story." Kirkus Review has also raved about it. One of the problems these days, Stephen, as you're running into, Stephen and his lovely, lovely wife, who has part of the dedication in here, Susan, who've been married for almost 50 years and have lived in Elmhurst for 20-some of those years, right?
12, I think.
12?
Yeah, we moved from Oak Park to Elmhurst.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Western suburbs.
I'm
a city kid. It's the western suburbs. He will be at the Oak Park Library. What night are you there? Thursday, Wednesday. I'm looking it up. I am
Saturday the...
Next Saturday.
29th.
Saturday the 29th of... yes, indeed.
27th. Sorry.
Wait, you have private things going. What are these private things you're doing out there? You don't have to tell me. But
no, at homes, people are hosting gatherings for their friends, and I see the pitch there.
You have a lot of events. He also has a fine website where you can get all sorts of information. And your book trailer is wonderful.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, she read it.
You did a lovely job, Susan, reading that thing. You find the images, too?
Yeah.
And the book trailer, if my endorsement isn't hooking you, then the book trailer should hook you. The 1-2 punch of Kogan and Susan Jordan's book trailer will absolutely hook you. It must have been an unbelievably empowering thing for you to finish this book. Do you remember? You seem to me to be a guy who does a lot of revising.
I do a lot of revising. I put it down and said, we're getting close to the whole thing. I mean, it's done. Now it's going back and tightening things up a lot. And what I've tried to do is get rid of as many adverbs as I possibly could and start using verbs.
That's the Elmore Leonard method. That's the Elmore Leonard method.
He said, if it sounds like it's been written, tear it up and write it again. But
yes. I mean, Tatiana and the Russian Wolves. Russian Wolves, as we said, being the sort of the phrase for trouble and or psychic anxiety.
That morphed into insanity.
Yeah. It's a wonderful... It's a wonderful phrase, and the book
but
cover.
But wolves come into, I mean, Russian novels I've read and all this other stuff, they're generally talking about wolves.
Oh, they're always wolves. They're always wolves in
out
these
there
Russian novels. They're always wolves in Russian novels. Having finished this book, I know that, in a sense, this kind of Oak Park Library next week and doing this show and doing a website, it's a chore. Is it a chore for you?
No, because my wife does most of that. I've delegated that, or she gladly took it up, knowing that I'm not very good at that. And how long have you, Steve, avoided Facebook? And you go, until about 2 weeks ago that I vaguely know how to run this thing and the rest of it. And I still have a flip phone, these little badges of courage that, you know.
But now, do you consider yourself, I know you were in a writer's group, were you not?
Yeah. Well, the trade-off there is
I'll read your stuff and criticize it. You read my stuff. Because if you send stuff that's unpublished to really good friends, they generally won't read it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just a fact.
Did you find the reading group helpful to you?
In some cases, very good. I'd be sitting there and you're going, these three people are really good critics, and that's the reason I come. The other ones are...
these three people are idiots, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not that harsh.
Who's your first reader? Susan, your first reader?
Yeah. Very good editor. Going through, we have a difference in punctuations, but styles.
Oh, that's minor.
That's fine.
You must be... The sense of accomplishment one feels in writing a novel, and I've interviewed dozens, if not hundreds, of novels, varies from author to author. Some are so empowered by seeing the finished product that they immediately start writing the next one.
I've started that, but it wasn't because I was getting tired of sitting around and rewriting this, and so I started with something new that would give me something else to do. I was told in high school and freshman English that you don't know how to write. And so I went out and got a style book and did it that way. And I do know how to write.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, I was surprised because it is much more accomplished than I thought it might be, because first novels, unless you're, you know, the Bernard Malamud or something, first novels tend to be exercisers in some sort of self-indulgence, and this is not.
Yeah, and the melodrama gets pretty high on those and the rest of it. And the English sort of gets hackneyed, or you know, they didn't read the Elmore Leonard 10 points in writing, which is
really
crucial.
Which is also spectacular. Which is, I went out.
Oh, how people talk.
And oh, I know.
Have you heard the story? His mother phoned him one time and said, I just finished, my bridge group just started reading this book, and where do you learn such language? And he said, I'm writing about Detroit cops and gangsters. One, they talk that way. Well, you don't, do you? And he said, well, 3 years in the Navy didn't help either. And
Stephen, it's a pleasure to meet you. I have to thank Pat Hickey and Mike Houlihan for introducing us. Stephen Evans Jordan, he also, as I said, has a wonderful website, which is Stephen, with a PH, StephenEvansJordan.com.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my God. No, I mean, I would have had you if the book was terrible, because I like Pat and Hooley, but the book is...
Well, I knew I was weighing in on that
without even knowing you. The book is really, really good. It is titled Tatiana and the Russian Wolves, Your Wife is a Doll, and go to the website. You'll find out where he's going to be and how to order the book, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to the last half hour of the Hawks Shortened After Hours show with me, Rick Kogan. Visitors are coming in here. It's unbelievable. It is my distinct pleasure to have back on. I hope to have him back every time he writes about one of my favorite characters. David Hamlin, how are you?
I'm fine, sir. Good evening.
It really is nice to have. When were you last on? When were we talking about your debut novel, Winter in Chicago? How long ago was that?
Roughly 18 months, perhaps.
Wow, is it really that long? Well, I'll tell you, that's a really good indication of how wonderful a character is Winter in this book. The newest book is Winter Gets Hot, and at the end of the interview, tell me I'm wrong if my memory doesn't serve, David, you said you were already working on a sequel. It is my great pleasure to announce that sequel is Winter Gets Hot, set in Chicago in roughly 1977, dedicated to the wonderful your wife and my friend Sydney. This must have been a little easier to write than the first one, or maybe not, David, was it?
Well, it was easier in that I had a much better feel for this character and the characters that surround her. It was a little tougher because the issue that Emily confronts in this one is somewhat more complicated and a little more challenging. But like the first one, I had such fun that none of that ultimately mattered.
Well, and Emily Winter is such a compelling character and attractive character that on the back, there's a quote on the back of the current novel, Winter Gets Hot, from one Rick Kogan, that says, "What I find so compelling is Emily's determination. I wish I'd met her at Ricardo's in 1975. You are, it's interesting to me, David, and we can talk in the midst of talking about this, about your career too, that you were here kind of in the mid-70s for a few years doing a very, very, what I think is God's work, but also a very high-pressure kind of job. You are taken with that era in Chicago. Why, David? What is it about the 1970s in this town that so grabs you?
Well, two things. Then as now, Chicago has an energy that I just find compelling. There's a lot going on in that town all the time, and one of the things I wanted to do when I started this series was to capture that energy and the incredible diversity of things that people can do while they're in Chicago. So there was that piece of it, but the other part of it is that it was an extraordinarily vibrant time for constitutional issues. There was a lot going on in the city which fed directly into my work with ACLU, but more importantly, fed into constitutional confrontations that I have always found fascinating. And this one deals with police surveillance of political activity.
Well, you went there's a mention
rife in Chicago in that era.
Well, the ACLU is in here. There are other things in this book. Will you please, because I don't want to do it, because it gives me the chills, will you describe remind some listeners and enlighten other listeners about something called the Red Squad? What was the Red Squad, David Hamlin? Because that plays a pretty considerable part in your latest novel. What was the Red Squad?
The Red Squad was a division of the Chicago Police Department, which was mirrored in most other major metropolitan cities. They were police officers who worked both above and below the sight lines of the public, investigating what might be called subversives. The original Red Squad in Chicago was created because business leaders and bankers were concerned about the rise of the union movement, so they started investigating union organizers as a way of trying to quell the union movement. And as happened in other cities, the organization, the Red Squad, transformed itself from looking at unions to looking at communists in the 50s, and then in the 60s and 70s, looking at the full range, largely, of left-wing political organizations, anti-war demonstrators, civil rights activists, folks who were giving politicians difficulty or whom the city believed were somehow a threat to the city's security. They were an insidious organization.
Perfect word. Perfect word, David Hamlin. Perfect word.
One of the things that drew me to this particular topic is that while the litigation in Chicago and elsewhere against these organizations ultimately all but shut them down because their activities were fundamentally a violation of basic constitutional rights.
No question.
And there were very large dollar settlements involved in most of those suits. But I was intrigued by the notion of the impact of being an organization being infiltrated by a Red Squad operative or someone being seduced into becoming a Red Squad operative, and the impact of that on the organization itself. I wanted to look at the more personal impact of a group of police officers whose job was to disrupt and otherwise disassemble perfectly legitimate civic organizations, in this case one I made up.
Yeah.
But the Red Squad was notorious in Chicago and other places for investigating just about everybody. Anybody who demonstrated in Chicago in the 60s or 70s spotted the Red Squad agents. They were always the guys in the black shoes.
See, that's the thing, too. They were so easily identifiable when they, but insidious is the word. The organization that you make up, David Hamlin, in and that sets things off for my girl, Emily Winter, in this. Emily Winter is a reporter for a radio news reporter, and she changes stations in the book, but she still gets no respect. The institution you made up is called the Chicago Alliance for Responsible Democracy, a very good name, a card. And Emily gets involved in the relatively gruesome murder of someone who works for Card, and even though in your first novel, and yes, she is a fictional character, that she proved herself a great investigative reporter and something of a able private eye, she is still not a court. When she wants to jump into this case, and you can detail the case a little, David, she is still, you know, she's being sent out to cover, if memory serves, like, you know, a bunch of people trying to do the longest, biggest, you know, pajama party at Northwestern or something, right?
Yes, she has moved to television, actually.
Oh, that's right.
She's given the traditional role for women in that era, which was a featured reporter. She does interviews, she covers quirky stories. But her instincts and her drive to be more than just, as she says, a jumped up weather girl.
Yeah.
Have her always looking for other stories, and she quite accidentally stumbles across a gruesome murder. And I want to spend a moment on the word gruesome, because
yeah, please.
You got it absolutely right.
I use that too.
I wanted that to come through. One of the things that bothers me about mystery narrative fiction these days is that a murder takes place and everybody moves on immediately.
Right.
Emily is on the scene of a murder, and it sickens her to see it. And one of the things I wanted to try and communicate in that early portion of the book is the extraordinary impact that something like that has on people.
Yep.
And Emily is not only a determined reporter, but she's a sensitive young woman. And her encounter with this horrible scene, which was not all that easy to write, I must say.
Oh, I'll bet, David. No, it gave me the chills.
It was important to me to get the audience to look at how really difficult it is to happen upon a scene like that, and it's impossible to pretend that it doesn't affect you, in much the same way that it's impossible to pretend that a spy inside your own organization doesn't affect the organization.
Yeah.
I wanted Emily to respond to what she saw. And you're quite right. The minute she discovers that she's the first reporter on the scene, she calls her boss and says, "I've got this great story." And her boss says, "You have to go cover the soft news assignment that I originally gave you."
She was off to cover. She was off to sort of go see Annie or something, wasn't she? At the
yes.
Yeah.
This is actually a not entirely fictional construction of mine. There was a traveling company of Annie in Chicago at that time, and one of the things that they did with that particular show was to recruit local children to serve as the other orphans in Annie's orphanage.
Yeah.
And Emily is assigned to go interview those children and their stage mom.
God, yeah, a slick feature if I ever heard one. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah, it's... It is not exactly a crime story, and while she relents at that point, she is an extremely determined young woman, and she wants to follow up on this story. She doesn't believe that the reporter who is assigned to it is going to do anything other than a superficial job.
Superficial job, yeah.
And she, in a rather dramatic moment, she finagles her way into convincing her boss that she really is a good reporter who can do good television news, and leverages that moment into an agreement that she and the other reporter will both work on this story, not side by side, but on parallel tracks, and the story takes off from there.
Well, David, as much as you know, as much as I enjoyed your first book, Winter in Chicago, this is, I don't want to say it's more accomplished, but I get a sense that it's more sure-footed to me. Did you bit off certainly more, and there are more facets to it, but do you feel that too? Was it easier for you to write this novel than the first one?
You're very kind to say so. I can't say that it was easier, but I did feel like I had a better understanding of who this character was and how I wanted her to proceed further down the path she travels. And I grew very fond in the first novel of her coterie of friends and acquaintances and family who all kind of support her and help her along, so that I knew them all fairly well. This is an issue which both then and now was near and dear to me, so that the kind of overarching story of the Red Squad and its work with civic or against civic organizations was something I very much wanted to explore. So it felt a little more natural to me,
yeah.
I think, this
yeah.
time. But you and I hasten to add, while I've done a lot of other things, I'm fairly new at this game.
Oh, so, I know. You wrote in, I can't remember what the year was, but your first book was about the contretemps, the conflict between the Nazis who wanted to march and the people in Skokie who did not want them to march. David has a great website. It's DMH Writes. That's DMHWRITES.com, where you can order these first two novels of his. I gotta think there's another one, David, but the other thing that imbued that first novel and imbues this one too is your affection for an understanding of this city through Emily's eyes. You find Chicago fascinating. You love it too, don't you?
I do, and I'm not sure I love it quite as much as Emily herself does, but I'm very fond of the place. And one of the challenges that I found this time around was to explore other aspects of Chicago.
Sure, sure.
So she, for example, she gets to go to Wrigley Field, and this is the 70s, so of course the Cubs lost. That could be
a lot of decades in the 20th century.
It could indeed. It's not like it was an uncommon occurrence. The one of the things I try to do in these books is to remain as true to the period of time as I can.
Yeah.
And the game Emily attends actually did take place in the first four innings. The St. Louis Cardinals scored 20 runs.
no surprise there. No surprise
none,
there.
None whatsoever. And I regretted in the first one that I couldn't find a way to work in one of what I think is one of Chicago's most extraordinarily beautiful structures, Roby House near
yeah.
the University of Chicago
sure.
campus. So I deliberately found a way to not only put Emily in front of that structure, but to communicate some of the extraordinary calm and peace, which for me, that building, that structure represents. It
yeah.
is beautiful and serene all at once. It really does, as Emily says, looks like it floats on the ground. It's an amazing structure.
Well,
and it's very much a part of Chicago, and as you have suggested, that's precisely what Emily is about. She is of and by Chicago.
No question. And so, even though you've only spent a few years here, you are getting quite a bookshelf of Chicago novels, I hesitate to even ask because I want it so badly. Is there another Emily Winter novel in you, David Hamlin?
There is definitely another Emily Winter or novel or two in me, but I have taken a break from Emily, and I now have I've just finished a very strong, I hope, first draft of a mystery with a male protagonist set in contemporary Los Angeles. I would hope to do for LA what I've done for Chicago, with a slightly more jaundiced point of view.
Yeah, I hate LA. But I will read anything.
Me too.
I know. I will read anything you write, David Hamlin.
Thank you. You're
I
so
was
fine.
Really quite taken with, it's hard to do a sequel, but Emily Winter, your great creation, is even more full-blown and even more artful and talented in Winter Gets Hot. David, my love to your bride. And next time you get to Chicago, I got to meet you face-to-face.
I would love to do that.
Me too. Thank you. The latest book, novel, Winter Gets Hot, the eagerly anticipated sequel to Winter in Chicago. The author, David M. Hamlin, the website, DMHWrites.com. We'll take a little commercial break, and I will slip in an event coming up Wednesday that you need to attend. Thanks for listening to my two authors and to me. I want to tell you that John Grisham is making his first appearance here at an Anderson Bookshop event. He's going to be with my great friend Scott Turow at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli Theater at 5021 Highland. You know who John Grisham is. You know who Scott Turow is. John's latest book is called The Reckoning. You can just Google Scott Turow, John Grisham, Wednesday, and you can go see them and get his new book. I am very pleased to have in here David Plyer, one of the rare people at this station. I absolutely admire David.
That is so nice of you.
With some underage kid drinking or something. I don't know what he's doing. That's your son, right?
That is my son. Yeah. What she just told me in the car on the way over. My girlfriend found a guy that looks a lot like me, so I got his ID, and we went to a couple bars last night. And I'm like, well, at least he told me.
Well, at least he told you. It's better that he didn't tell you. My girlfriend knows a guy who looks just like me and told me to get lost.
Yeah, that's true.
He's legal and I'm not, Dad.
That's so true.
Oh, that's great. That's tough, man, that first long-distance relationship.
Yeah, that's what it is.
What do you got on the show tonight?
Well, we're playing two old-time radio shows. One is the Black Museum and Mystery in the Air, but I'm also bringing with me something that a buddy of mine's dad had recorded back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I thought, why not, if it's WGN Radio Theater, play something from WGN? And I got, since it's Halloween, Eddie Schwartz talking to ghost hunter Richard Crow.
Bill Cosby.
Yeah, I wish it was.
Scariest man in the world. Yeah. It was Bill Cosby again. Talking to Richard Crow?
Richard Crow. Remember ghost hunter Richard Crow?
Oh, my God.
They're both gone, obviously.
I remember Richard. Yes, I do. He used to run. So he was a fascinating guy. I wrote about him many times. But when you would sometimes see Richard Crow in the early days of ghost tours, hustle a bus filled of Japanese tourists, convincing them that there's the ghost of a goat wandering behind the bar at the Billy Goat.
Yeah, right.
He was an operator, but I liked Richard a lot.
Yeah, Resurrection Mary, that was the big one.
I know. Well, that sounds like a great show.
It'll be fun.
It's always great to see
you. Nice to see you as well, sir. I admire you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a mutual admiration society in here.